Right up. Our Bible reading this morning comes from James chapter 2, starting at verse 14 through to verse 26. What good is it, my brothers, if someone says he has faith but does not have works? Can that faith save him? If a brother or sister is poorly clothed and lacking in daily food, and one of you says, "Go in peace, be warmed and filled," without giving him the needs, things needed for the body, what good is that? So also faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead. But someone will say, "You have faith and I have works. Show me your faith apart from your works, and I will show you my faith by my works." You believe that God is one. You do well. Even the demons believe and shudder. Do you want to be shown, you foolish person, that a faith apart from works is useless? Was not Abraham our father justified by works when he offered up his son Abraham on the altar? You see that faith was active along with his works, and faith was completed by his works, and the scripture was fulfilled that says, "Abraham believed God, and it was counted to him as righteousness, and he was called a friend of God." You see that a person is justified by works and not by faith alone. And in the same way, was not also Rahab the prostitute justified by works when she received the messengers and sent them out by another way? For as the body apart from the spirit is dead, so also faith apart from works is dead.
Thanks, Noel. One of the 20th century's moments of great achievement. July 20th, 1969, wobbly pictures on the telly and a very crackly broadcast over the radio. Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin taking the Eagle down to land on the moon. First time ever. They're trained up to the eyeballs for this mission and well out of reach if anything goes wrong. And then just before hitting the surface of the moon in the target zone, they find that they're coming down in the middle of a field of boulders. So it's one of those dreadful moments of having to ad-lib and do some very sharp manoeuvring in a vehicle that is being landed for the first time ever. And Neil Armstrong does it. And he finds a good spot. And then with 25 seconds worth of fuel left, they land, and there's a pause, and Neil Armstrong says his first magic words for the day. Tranquility Base here, the Eagle has landed. And ground control says, "Roger, Tranquility, we copy you on the ground. You've got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We are breathing again. Thanks a lot." Long time ago now. A couple of weeks ago, the last man on the moon died. Now that leaves six people left alive who've walked there. But those six are definitely people who didn't just talk about it, they did it. But if they did talk about it, they are the ones that you would pay attention to, aren't they? If they were talking about what it's like to be on the moon. If you had one of those six surviving astronauts, then when they started talking about what it's like to walk around on the moon, or from Apollo 15 onwards, to drive around on the moon, when they talked about it, you'd really want to sit up and take notice. No gap between what they say and what they do. And to make a thing like that happen, there's the work of thousands of people not just talking but doing in a massive international collective effort. time may come when history adds perspective and we say, United States? Have I heard of the United States? Oh yes, of course, they were the country who sent the first people to the moon. But the Apollo people, the thing they said, they did. The gap between talking and doing is not always that small. John le Carré says, you don't have to remind me that a man is not equal to his rhetoric. That is, people don't always live up to what they say. But sometimes, it gets embarrassing. Now, my brother is the smart one in our family. Back when we were students, he was doing this postgraduate thing in maths, and he got some work at the uni as a maths tutor for undergraduates. And some of those maths undergraduates that he tutored were my friends. Some of them were members of the Christian group, the Evangelical Union, and they used to talk to my brother and try to persuade him to come along to gospel things at uni. Now, that's great. Except that university tutors also marked assignments. And even in those days, it wasn't hard to spot who'd been collaborating on assignments in maths when people have the same mistakes in their working and then go on sharing the same mistakes in the same way. It's a bit of a giveaway. What was really embarrassing was when the same people who were clearly sharing assignments were the ones advertising evangelistic events. Now, somehow my brother was not all that impressed. It's the gap between what we say and what we do. And when we read James, he is shining his spotlight into that gap. I mean, it's always there all through history. Up and down Lebanon and Syria, there are those old ruined crusader forts. And they are a monument to the far-off days in the 1000s AD when Pope Urban promised complete forgiveness of sins to anyone from Western Europe who would pick up a sword and go and hurt people in the Middle East. There is a gap in there somewhere. We've just had Australia Day, so think of some that Australians get antsy about. The English get terribly fond of old Oliver Cromwell, statue of him outside Parliament and all that. Great Christian leader from the 1600s, Puritan, with all the things that go with that, like education for everyone, legal aid, universal health care. Lord Protector of the People, founder of the English Republic, head full of his Bible. But then over in Ireland, twice guilty of what we would think of as massive war crimes. And we Australians, with our Irish convict thing, that's the bit that we will always remember. There's a gap. 150 years later, even closer to home right here, Samuel Marsden. Now, he is a very Australia Day one. I just say the name, and people who've grown up in Australia know he's a baddie. Samuel Marsden, Christian man coming out of the evangelical revival in England. He'd be right at home with us here in Wentie, chums with old Wilberforce and the anti-slavery crowd. At the end of the 1700s, he agrees to come as chaplain to a New South Wales loaded with convicts. He agrees to come for the sake of the gospel. And over in New Zealand, they love him. Brought the gospel to New Zealand. Hooray for Marsden, he's like an apostle to us. But here in New South Wales, and in Parramatta especially, it's his reputation as colonial magistrate and his name as the flogging parson that gets remembered. And we feel the gap. Now, if we want to get behind the reputation and find the man, it's easy enough to read his own letters and find out what was going on. But it's easier still just to go with Australian folklore and write him off as the flogging parson. But it's always the gap. What we say we believe and what we do. But is it a problem? When I was doing some course in sociology, it was a really basic rule that the values and ideas that people say they stick to are not necessarily the ones that control how they behave. I mean, we talk about the mercy of God, and we talk about the free forgiveness through Jesus. We talk about being justified by faith. We say all we're supposed to do is to trust in Jesus and hang on to the message of the gospel. And we know we are all scallywags anyway, or we wouldn't need to be saved. We know we are not perfect, just forgiven and all that. So, is it a problem if there's a gap between what we believe and what we do? Is it a problem if there's a gap? Well, by this time in the letter, James has got some of his readers squirming and looking for a let-out clause, and they're saying just that to him. And saying, look, James, you are carrying on about doing things all the time, but being a believer is not about doing things to get saved. We don't get saved by doing things. We get saved by faith. Paul says so in his letters. Romans 10, verse 9, almost certainly written before James wrote this. If you confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord, and you believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. Galatians 2, written well before this letter of James. We know that a person is not justified by works of the law, but through faith in Jesus Christ. So we've got this really strong idea, like a great big rock in the middle of the New Testament, that Jesus saves us and we trust in him to be saved, and that doing things, doing the commandments of the Old Testament, doing religious rituals, doing good deeds, whatever kind of doing works, that's not the thing that saves us with God. And we can get hold of that and say to James, faith we've got. Believing we have got, even if we're not perfect by your standards, James. Okay, let's take this believing out of the box and take a look at it. Take a look at this faith. What does it do? Is faith still faith when it just exists deep inside our head or deep inside our heart and there's no sign on the outside that it's even there? Is faith the same thing that Paul's talking about when it's inside us there somewhere, but no one can ever know because it never shows in anything we do? Is faith the same thing that Paul is talking about when it means we sort of sign up to a set of ideas that we believe, but it doesn't have any visible effects on how we treat people? See, in Romans, when Paul says, if you confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord and you believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. Paul lays on the believers, love one another with brotherly affection, outdo one another in showing honour. The faith that Paul talks about, the faith that's involved in being saved, shows itself in all sorts of surprising ways. So following James here, ask the question. When you say believe, what do you mean? Do you mean you think some things are true? You know, I believe in God, the Father Almighty, or whatever, meaning, yes, I think these things are true. What does James say? Verse 14. What good is it, my brothers, if someone says he has faith but does not have works? Can that faith save him? Or verse 17. So faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead. Now, do you catch that? The I believe that begins and ends with saying, I think there is a God. That I believe belongs on a marble slab in the morgue. Or if that's not direct enough, try verse 20. Do you want to be shown, you foolish person, that faith apart from works is useless? As I go through life, I find I have to be a little bit diplomatic from time to time. People get a bit unhappy if you tell them that their religion is dead, or better still, their religion is useless. You want to try it on someone sometime. Hi, did you have a nice time at church? Yes. Believe something, did you? Yes. Pretty useless, isn't it? Bit dead. Not the way to make friends and influence people. But James lays it on thick. Why? Verse 15. Now watch this one carefully. James is making a point by saying something outrageous, by telling us a little story that is completely outrageous. He's not saying this is what you have to do to have real faith. He's using an example of something so stupid, so appalling, that he would never, ever expect to see it happen. Verse 15. If a brother or sister is poorly clothed and lacking in daily food, and one of you says to them, go in peace, be warmed and filled, without giving them any of the things needed for the body, what good is that? There's a very old Snoopy comic strip based on this. There is Snoopy sitting in the snow, shivering, and Charlie Brown and Schroeder come along, and they decide to go up and comfort him. Next slide, thanks, Roland. Be of good cheer, Snoopy. Yes, be of good cheer. And then off they go. Snoopy is shivering as much as ever with his question mark. What was that all about? But notice the person that James talks about in verse 15 isn't a homeless person you've never met asking for money in the street. It's not a shifty character that costs you around the corner from the pub in Parramatta and tells you a complicated story about an apple, an orange, a dead aunt and a thermometer that they left in a locker at Central Station and then asks for money. Verse 15, if a brother or sister is poorly clothed and lacking in daily food, a brother or sister is a member of our own congregation. It's the person that we stand next to while we sing about how much we believe in God and we love Him. It's someone we definitely know, and we know they are not faking it. So we say, oh, cheer up, old thing, it could be worse. Go in peace, be warmed and filled, but we don't lend a hand. It's a totally outrageous picture, isn't it? James's point isn't, if we really had faith, we'd do something to help the brother or sister. He knows that we'd lend a hand to the brother or sister. Of course we would. No, James is pointing out something that we're going to do, whoever we are. James is saying that the faith that only lives inside our head, is as useless as the imaginary person who doesn't lend a hand. Faith that just lives inside our head is as much a waste of space as the person in verse 15. And don't think that the content of what we believe is going to make the important difference. Verse 19, you believe that God is one? Now, for first century people who James is writing to, that really is a big deal. Book of Deuteronomy, Old Testament, says God is one. In the old Jewish stories, not the Old Testament, but the old Jewish stories, Abraham was supposed to be different from the people around him because he believed that God was one. And they can say in James's time, we are convinced that God is one, and that sets us apart from all those people with Jupiter and Mars and Venus and all the others. First century people can say, we believe God is one. That defines us. Verse 19, you believe that God is one, you do well. Even the demons believe and shudder. So you've latched onto something that is true about God, and you say that it's true. Maybe you even defend that against all comers. Is that faith? Is that trust? Is that relationship? What is that believing drive you to do? Faith, the real faith that is in our relationship with God through Jesus, it won't just sit in our head and enjoy the music. It won't let us just go to Bible study and hum and ha learnedly while we debate about the nature of God. The real faith, the kind of faith that Paul talks about back in Romans, it boils over into action. It drives us. It won't sit still. So James gives us two examples. Abraham and Rahab. Now, why Abraham? Abraham's not just the ancestor of the Israelites. He's the first person we get told in the Bible who believes something. Doesn't even get mention about believing before Abraham. The bit that's quoted here in verse 23, Abraham believed God and it was counted to him as righteousness. Abraham believed God, it was counted to him as... So we might say, well, that's it. All you need to do is believe God, like Abraham. End of story. What did Abraham believe in God look like? God gave Abraham a promise that he would give him descendants, he would give him land, he would bless him, and through him he would bless the nations. But especially for old, childless Abraham, God would give him descendants. Abraham believed God. He believed God would keep his promise. And that believing, was it just a comfortable feeling deep within that kept him going? Abraham believed God meant God. Abraham trusted God to keep his promise. Then we get the terrible story in Genesis 22 where God tests the edges of that trust. God tested Abraham. Take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you. The whole thing in that chapter is really bizarre and disturbing. It's supposed to be. Does Abraham really believe God can do what he promises, even under these circumstances? If Abraham does go through with the act, there's no way God's promise can happen. But God calls Abraham to trust him. Will Abraham trust? And as we read it in the chapter in Genesis, Abraham and Isaac wander off to the mountain. They leave the servants at the foot of the mountain. They go up by themselves, Abraham carrying the knife, Isaac carrying the firewood. Genesis never lets us in on what is going on in Abraham's head or what he thinks of such an appalling instruction. All through, it's like we're watching Abraham from a very great distance. On the way, we get the conversation between Abraham and Isaac, with Isaac beginning to suspect something and saying, "Where is the lamb for the burnt offering?" And as they go on up the mountain, we're thinking, how is Isaac ever going to get out of this one? Or even, how is God going to get out of this one? And then at the last minute, with Isaac tied up on top of the firewood and Abraham raising the knife, the angel leaps in, "Abraham, do not lay your hand on the boy or do anything to him, for now I know that you fear God, seeing that you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me." And Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked, And behind him was a ram caught in a thicket by his horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered it up as a burnt offering instead of his son. When we get up to that bit, I think we all feel a little bit like Mission Control at the moment when Armstrong says, "Tranquility Base here, the eagle has landed." You know, we copy you on the ground, you've got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We are breathing again now. But the point is in that bit, now I know that you fear God. See, Abraham actually believes God. Because he trusts God, he acts. When God says, he trusts. So if Abraham believed God and it was counted to him as righteousness, that isn't just Abraham had a belief deep in his head. It's that Abraham put his money where his mouth was and his trust spilled out into action when he trusted God to keep his word. And the same with Rahab the prostitute from Jericho in the Old Testament. Rahab said to the Israelites, "The Lord your God, he is God in the heavens above and on the earth beneath." Good. That's what she says she believes. Does she believe that? Yes. How do we know? Because of what she did. Because she hid the Israelites from the guards and gave them a way to escape from the town and get back to their own people, and she backed them up with her life, her fortune, and her sacred honor. She believed, and it showed in what she did. And that, James wants us to know, is what faith looks like. And Paul will agree. It's what Romans faith looks like. It's what Galatians faith looks like. How about us? We say we believe. Every time we sing the songs or say the words, how does it show? What does James want us to do? He wants us to do the things he's been pressing us about all the way through his letter so far. Not just to talk about them, but to do them. Do we really believe God? How will it show? It will show when we stand firm when we're faced with temptation. We will stand firm because we trust God. It will show in how we treat our wealth and our money. We will learn to be generous with it and not totally fixated on it because we trust God. It will show when times are tough because we won't throw in the towel and blame God because we trust him. We believe he's going to keep his promises, even when, like Abraham, we cannot see how it will happen. How will our faith show? It will show when we are quick to hear, slow to speak, slow to anger. It will show in the way that we use our ears and our mouths to listen before we speak and to speak sense when we do speak. Be doers of the word and not hearers only, deceiving yourselves. Our faith will show because we act on what God tells us in Scripture. We don't just treat it like something to talk about. Religion that is pure and undefiled before God the Father is this: to visit orphans and widows in their affliction and to keep oneself unstained from the world. How will our faith show? It'll show because we really put love into action and we don't just talk about it. It will show because we care about each other and the people in our community and in our world. It will show because there's some kind of reality to the love for us as well as talk. James isn't launching into some weird new message here that you get to heaven by enduring temptation or speaking wisely or showing love. He is fully in favour of faith. But he wants the faith to be real faith. Not just saying we believe some ideas. He wants the faith to be the dynamo inside turning around and driving us into action because we trust God. If the faith is real on the inside, then those are the things that will be real on the outside. And if the faith is real on the inside, then the gap between what we say we believe and what we do really does get smaller. Wouldn't it be great if the gap disappeared altogether? If the faith is real on the inside, then it comes out in action. And then we don't have some kind of hypocrites. We really do have a believer. And that's what we want to be, isn't it?